anybody remembers what we did yesterday? So if not, let's look at the videos. So we talked about sort of the general scheme, and I'm yet to realize it, right? Even in the UK, I'm kind of clearly building up to it, but it's not yet quite there. And then we, on the second hour, we define finite type invariants. Is it all visible? Is it good enough? Is it? So we define finite type invariants basically by iterating derivatives, where derivative just means over minus under. Okay? And finite type invariants were like polynomials. We found many examples. The linking number, the constants were finite type in a silly way. The linking numbers, the Jones polynomial was not a finite type invariant, but a series of finite type invariants. So all the information in it is contained in finite type invariants. And then we started studying the nth derivative. We said, if an invariant is of type M, then its mth derivative will be somehow a combinatorial gadget, a constant. So let's study these systems of constants. And we concluded that the mth derivative, which by the way determines the invariant up to invariants of type M minus 1. So it's completely suitable for inductive study. But anyway, the mth derivative is a functional on core diagrams. So by the way, in particular, it implies that there are finitely many invariants of type M, because you have at most as many as there are core diagrams, and there are finitely many of those, plus the number of invariants of type M minus 1, which again is finite by induction. Okay, so this done, we went to hour number 3, and in it, we said, in fact, not every linear functional on core diagrams comes from a finite type invariant, and we found two constraints. One was the framing independence relation, shown here, which was a constraint only in the case of invariants of unframed knots. Okay? And the other one was universally holding, and it was the 4T relation, which was derived by pulling a lasso around the knot, around the double point, and the relation corresponding to it, I suppose, was written here at some point, and that's the so-called 4T relation. Okay? And then I gave examples, and I computed the weight system of the Conway polynomial, and it's partially an example, and it was partially an example, partially an exercise. I really encourage you to do the exercises, because otherwise it's unfair. I mean, I'm working on the evening preparing tomorrow's lecture. You should be doing something too, right? So anyway. And then the last thing we did was, in the third hour, was we started the motion towards, the move towards Lie algebras. And we said that's the isomorphism between AC and AT. I hope you can you see it, or is it too small? I mean, I can enlarge it a bit by shrinking the motion picture. But, so basically by switching from core diagrams modulo 4T to trivalent diagrams like this, modulo, well, the only really necessary relation was STU, but may as well put the others as well, even though there are consequences. So the IHX, which is sort of Jacobi, and the antisymmetry, which is sort of antisymmetry. Okay? And then in the last hour, we did several things. Well, okay, I mentioned that there are a few competing definitions, and there are parallel theories at least. but none as successful as this one, I should say. And then we talked about the proof of this bracketized theorem, and then we actually use it to relate things with Lie algebras. So, given a Lie algebra, and a representation and a metric, I constructed three tensors, and using them, I constructed a linear functional on A. So, assuming the theorem that is yet to be proven, that every linear functional on A comes from a finite type invariant, right, we already know that every finite type invariant gives a linear functional on A. We still have to show the other way, that every linear functional on A comes from a finite type invariant. But assuming this, and given that Lie algebras constructs linear functionals on A, we get invariants, one per Lie algebra and representation, and I guess metric. Okay? By the way, is this construction natural or not? So, you know, if you would have asked a not-theorist to come up with this construction, or, you know, a not-theorist might have come up with the space AC, right? But then, would a not-theorist guess this construction? The answer is probably not. But often mathematical discoveries go this way. So, I mean, people coincidentally know two different subjects and then notice that they are the same. Okay? So, basically, a Lie theorist might have been interested in figuring out what are all the formulas you can write given a certain amount of information. Given a certain amount of information, namely a Lie bracket, a metric, which is a relatively minor thing, and a representation, what are all the numbers you can write? What are all numerical invariants you can produce out of this information in an invariant way? Well, without choosing a basis. So really, I wrote it by choosing a basis, but the end result is basis independent. So a Lie theorist would have come up right away with the answer that you just have to look at all possible ways of contracting these tensors with each other. And since the interesting ones of those tensors have three legs, have three indices, the set of all such contractions is exactly a collection of trivalent graphs. And then you could, and the Lie theorist would have noticed right away that those contractions, because of the Jacobi identity, satisfy the IHX relation, and, you know, because of the other Lie theoretic constraints, satisfy the other conditions, STU and antisymmetry. So basically, a Lie theorist would have come up, and in fact, Lie theorists have come up with these constructions, without any knowledge of knot theory, and then it's just a coincidence that you, and then it's just sort of a lucky coincidence to note that the two are the same, that the thing constructed by Lie theory is the thing needed by knot theory. Okay? Was this a sufficient review? Too much of a review? I think I should start every day with a review, but tell me if I'm doing too much of it. Okay, anyway, end of review, and let's start with today. So, well, there is today we'll follow two handouts, but not everything will be handouted. So parts of it will be on the blackboard, and I think I want to start with a blackboard part. So I want to prove the fundamental theorem. So the fundamental theorem says theorem, and it's called the fundamental theorem of finite type invariants. Okay, it's not the fundamental theorem of mathematics, just of this subject, okay? And I'll say in a minute why it's called the fundamental theorem. But it says the following, or here is one way of saying it. For every W which is a linear functional on AM. But you see, the fundamental theorem holds on the two variants, both the framed and unframed. It's a little bit easier to prove in the unframed version. So for every linear functional on AM reduced, where you do mod out by the framing independence relation, so for every linear functional, meaning for every element of the dual, there exists an invariant V. Well, let me introduce notation. V sub M will be finite type invariants of type M. So there exists a finite type invariant of type M such that the M-th derivative of V is the W you started from. So why is it the fundamental theorem? Well, obviously it's fundamental. But also, itself a bit like an analog of the fundamental theorem of calculus. Fundamental theorem of calculus tells you something about you can integrate, and then the derivative of the thing you've integrated is the thing you started from. So basically, W is a candidate derivative, and the theorem says that you can integrate it to something whose derivative is what you started from. So it's even more analogous to calculus than that. Furthermore, at least the first proof literally involves integration. Okay? So the first proof of this theorem literally involves writing messy integrals. Okay, so, but before proving it, let me state a claim. The claim is that this theorem, so theorem above, is equivalent to the following statement. There exists an invariant Z, so it's a function from knots to, and I suppose for today, knots means unframed knots. So I don't know, maybe to be consistent, I'll make it AR, KR. So reduced modulo Rademeister 1. Okay? So there exists an invariant from K with values in A reduced. And if you want to be pedantic, I want it completed. So I want to allow power series. I want to allow things with increasing degrees, with arbitrary high degrees. Okay? But you see, I will not be pedantic. Anytime I write a reduce, I will pretend that it's I will assume it's completed. A reduce is defined to be some completion. Okay? Which is a universal finite type invariant. So universal finite type invariant, or alternatively an equivalent name is it's an expansion. Okay? Which means, so the meaning of the notion universal finite type invariant is the following. So by the way, a universal finite type invariant is not a finite type invariant. It's sort of a series that contains all finite type invariants in it, but it's not in itself a finite type invariant. Anyway, the condition that has to be satisfied is the following. If a K belongs to KM reduced, so remember what this means. This means knots with M double points. So this is so-called M singular knots. So knots with exactly M double points. Okay? Then Z of K. So remember that any invariance with values in a abelian group can be extended to singular knots. Okay? So if you have a singular knot, knot with double points, you can extend any invariant by replacing double point by over minus under. So when I write this, it doesn't mean, it sort of means not the original Z, but the extended Z. Okay? So I want this to be, okay, remember another thing, if you have an M singular knot, it has an underlying core diagram, right? So really we have that M singular knots modulo, we really have that M singular knots map to M singular knots modulo the image of M plus 1 singular knots, so modulo setting over is equal to under, and this is what used to be core diagrams. This is what became core diagrams. So if you have a K here, then it will go to a diagram here, which I will denote by the diagram of K. Okay? Or, you know, it's just the equivalence class of K. Okay? So I want Z of K to be the diagram of K, which of course it can be thought of as an element in A reduced, plus, so the diagram of K is of degree, it has M chords, so it is of degree M. So I want D of K, I want to get D of K plus higher degree terms. So I don't care about the higher degree terms, but I do care that in degree K, degree M, I will have exactly this, and before, I will have zero. In degrees lower than M, I will have zero. Okay? Are you with me? Is this okay? I'll continue taking pictures of the blackboard. You see, from your perspective, it's 1 minute less to hear my voice, and it's only an advantage. Okay. So, proof, but what I mean is proof of claim. I want to show that, that constructing a universal finite type invariant is enough. So I suppose I have to show two things. I have to show this direction and then the opposite direction. So this direction means that I can assume that there exists a Z. Okay? And now give me a W and I need to integrate it. I need to construct the corresponding V. But you see, Z goes from K to, let me write it differently. Z goes from K to A reduced. W goes from A reduced to the ground field. Sorry, I should have said everything here is over the rationals. Or in fact, first iteration, even just over the complex numbers. Okay? Anyway, so assume you have a W and we were given Z, but then it's clear how to construct the invariant V. Just make it be that. Okay? So the only thing I need to check is that V is a finite type and that it has the right weight system. Okay? So we set this and then I claim that V is of type M. So if K is M plus 1 singular, V better vanish on it. So let's check it. So what's V of K? V of K is W of Z of K, right? But Z of K So this is W of the diagram underlying K plus higher terms. So the three dots here, in fact four, mean higher terms, terms of higher degree. But the point is that W is of degree M. Okay, W belonged to the degree M part, dual. So, I mean, here I implicitly extended it to be, well, to be a linear functional on all of AM, of A reduced, but really, sorry, I should have said it, I'm extending it by zero. Okay, so on the degree M piece, it's the original W, and everywhere else it's zero. But you see, so W in particular maps all of this to zero, because this is degree M plus one, and this is degree M plus one and more. So, we're done. Okay? Okay. Now, if K... So this proves that V is finite type. Is type M. So, okay? So, V is type M. But now... Well, okay. But now, if K is M singular, then V of K is by definition, well, this is differentiating V M times. So by definition, this is the weight system of V evaluated on the diagram corresponding to K. That's exactly how we defined the weight system on diagrams. It was the corresponding invariant on a knot whose singularities are like that diagram. On the other hand, by the same line of thought as above, it's W of DK, and the three dots disappear because they are in higher degrees. So we've shown that WV is equal to W. So, WV is equal to W. We've shown it on arbitrary diagrams, or we've shown it on the diagrams underlying arbitrary knots, so on arbitrary diagrams, so we're done. Okay? Good. So, let's do the other direction. The other direction is not a bit more exciting. Was this exciting? Are you... all having hard time containing yourself, like nobody is going to burst into singing and sort of. Okay, anyway, so regardless, let me prove the other direction. So I'll just write how to do it. Okay, so pick a basis. Pick bases. What do I want? M J of A M reduced. Okay, so where J goes from 1 to the dimension of A M reduced. Okay, so for each M, pick a basis of A M reduced. Okay, let W M J be the corresponding dual basis, let me shift the indices just to make it look like dual basis. So WMJ be the corresponding dual basis of AM same reduced dual, okay? And let VMJ be integrals of, so right, I have now lots and lots and lots of weight systems. So let's integrate all of them, and right, I'm assuming now that the fundamental theorem is true, so I can do that, okay? So let VMJ be integrals of WMJ, meaning that the weight system of VMJ is WMJ, okay? And now set Z of any knot K be the infinite sum as M goes from 0 to infinity of the sum as J goes from 1 to the dimension of AM reduced of take the invariant VMJ evaluated on the knot K and multiply it by the diagram you started from, by DMJ. So this sum, well, it's an infinite sum, but it's a, but the mth term in it is of degree m. So it's since I'm allowing series, since I've completed, it's convergent. So it belongs to AM, not AM, it belongs to A, sorry, to A reduced, to the direct sum of all A sub M reduced. Okay? And I claim that this is it. Okay? And in fact, let me leave it for you. So exercise, this is a universal finite type invariant in the sense defined over there. It's easy, okay? It's not a hard claim. And in fact, I don't need it. This is the direction I don't care about, because the plan is to prove the fundamental theorem by constructing a universal finite type invariant. Okay? So this is only to show you that I haven't wasted energy. So I mean by constructing a universal, that I'm not doing anything stronger than what was required. Okay? Okay. So let's start constructing the Concievich integral. So let me start constructing a universal finite type invariant. Do I have time? How much?
17 minutes.
Okay. So the construction is by a formula. And let me just show you the formula. Can't you see? So, again, you can ask yourself, oh my God, this is horrible. Infinitesimally better. So you can ask yourself, where did the formula come from? And, you know, there is no such thing brilliance in mathematics. Sorry, so I mean, nobody can come up with such a brilliant construction without having some background. So formulas like that come because people, the right people have been around the right formula for the right at the right time. Okay? So all the ingredients were present before, okay? Nevertheless, it's not how I'm showing you. It's not the way I'm showing it. I'm just flashing the formula, okay? So just keep it in mind, okay? Nobody is ever expected to come up with such. People don't come up with such things unless they happen to be in the right neighborhood by chance. Anyway, here's the formula. Oi, there is a notational There are some problems in the handouts that I made. First of all, this is not parentheses k, this is z of k. And second, z is actually not the invariant written here, is not the universal finite type invariant, but rather z tilde is. So z is the first step in the construction. Oh, if people don't have a copy of the handout, you can get one here. So anyway, nevertheless, let me tell you what z is. So take a knot, embed it. Here's how you construct the formula. Take a knot, embed it in the complex numbers cross the real numbers, which is R3. Okay? So, but I think of the complex plane as being drawn here and parameterized by parameters that I will denote z, and the extra dimension I will think of as t, defined by an extra parameter called t. Okay? And let me think, let's pretend that the knot is embedded in a Morse fashion. Okay? So it's smoothly embedded and it has finitely many critical points, finitely many maximas and minimas, and these maximas and minimas are non-degenerate. Okay? The second derivative is non-zero at this point. Okay? And it's clear that you can do it. I don't think I want to waste time on showing that. So embed the knot in this way. And then once it is embedded, it has a minimum time. So the minimum time where you see something of the knot, and it has a maximal time, which is the maximal time at which you see something of the knot. And then z of k, which is almost all of the Concievich integral. So z of k is the sum as m goes from 0 to infinity of an annoying factor times a multiple integral of dimension m, okay, on a space of dimension m. So an integral over t1 up to t1 less than t2 less than t3 less than tm, where all of these t's live between t min and t max. So basically an integral over all ways of placing four time or m time slight time points between the minimum and the maximum. Okay? Now, for each such choice of times, you sum over all applicable pairings. So what are applicable pairings? Well, at any given time, you choose two points, you sum over all choices of two points on the knot at that time. Okay, so it will be this pair. So for T3 it might be this pair of points, for T2 it might be this pair of points, and so on. Okay, and then let me denote the point, the first of these two points, z2, the point corresponding to time 2, let me denote the first of those z2 and the second one z2 prime. Okay? And then the sort of lovely part of the integral is you take the wedge product as I goes from 1 to m of dzi minus dzi prime divided by zi minus zi prime. So strictly speaking, well, basically so here's how you want to think of it. If you move t a little bit below or above, if you let any one of the t's move a little bit, the corresponding z's move a little bit too. Okay? So really you get a locally defined map from the choices of the t's to pairs of points in the plane. Okay? For each I, this is a one form on the complex plane. So for each I, you pull it back and it becomes a one form on the line. Now I have m points on the line, and m1 forms, I take all of the wedge all of those together, and I get an m form on the simplex of all choices of t1 up to tm. So you integrate this m form on the simplex, on that simplex. Except that's not the whole story. This so far just gives a number, but I wanted an element of A, right? So to get this element of A, you, for any such pairing, also defines a chord diagram, D sub P. Because any such pairing connects two points on the knot, so it connects two points on the knot. And when you, so basically I have a circle, the knot itself, with M chords marked on it. Okay? So this is the diagram underlying the pairing P. So this is the DP that I put here. And finally, there is an annoying sign. And the sign is defined as follows. So the knot was oriented, even though I didn't mark it on the picture. Right? All of our knots are oriented. So there is a direction of motion along the knot. Right? Now, each time you go through a point, you might either be going up or down. Okay? So take minus one to the number of down points on the pairing. A QED. Right, so that's the answer. No, it's not quite the answer, it's almost the answer. Okay? To get the answer, we still have to renormalize a little bit. Okay? So I need to show a lot of things. Let me start by showing, by explaining convergence. Convergence is the easiest. Okay? So, you might think that there is a problem if Zi approaches Zi prime, right? If the difference between Zi and Zi prime is small, then this blows up. Okay, and that's the only issue with convergence. That's the only thing that might harm convergence. But you see, and in fact here there is an example. If T1 goes towards the minimum, the distance between these two goes to zero. Okay? But fortunately, in that case, in the diagram DP, you will have a chord which is isolated. Right? And an isolated chord was set to zero by the framing independence relation. So you get a divergent integral, but as a coefficient of a diagram which is equal to zero, so that's fine. Okay? Okay, why is it an invariant? So, well, it's actually not yet an invariant. There is a small issue, and maybe I will postpone the issue and fix it to be an invariant later. But before that, let me explain why it is an invariant. So, let me start with a simplified version. Okay? So, rather than talking about... So, okay, maybe back to the previous picture. So, basically, if you cut this picture between any two horizontal time slices that contains no minimas and maximas, so like between this time and that time, all that you see is a braid. Right? So, my plan is to first show that you get, if you sort of restrict your attention to between two slices, you get an invariant of braids. So you can move the braid, if you move the braid smoothly around, nothing changes. And after that, and this will be the hard work, and after that it will be a little bit of sort of further tricks to see how to move the critical points around. Okay? So the main part is to get a braid invariant. Okay? So let me do that. So claim, the following is an invariant of braids. So the braid I will call B. And it is an invariant of braids embedded in the real numbers parameterized by T. So the letter T here has no real meaning except sort of it's a declaration. Every time I will speak about a variable that the first coordinate, I will use T. Okay? And likewise, cross the complex numbers parameterized by Z. And again, Z has no meaning except a declaration, except declarative. I will use the letter C to denote things living here. Okay? So what's B? Okay? B is, well, here's a picture of B. Thing like that. Okay? So I'll basically take the part of the Concievich formula which applies, which lives between here and here. So it will be an integral and a sum integral. By the way, this is somewhat a little bit of a tiny ideological point. I mean, integrations and sums are the same thing, so there should be a notation that combines them. So basically, take the sum integral of all t's, of all ordered t's that run between the minimum value and the maximum value, so all t1 up to tm which run between the minimum and the maximum value. Okay? In the sum, so you integrate over all such choices of t, and you sum over all pairings where for each t you choose two of the strands and connect them with a cord and label the left end of the cord or one end of the cord z1 and the zi and the other end of the cord zi prime. Okay? Then you do the same 2 pi r, sorry, and it's also a sum over m. This is also being summed over here. Okay? And then for every such choice of t's and a pairing, look at, well, divide by 2 pi I to the m, just to be annoying. Multiply by the wedge product of dzi minus dzi prime divided by zi minus zi prime, which is interpreted as before. And this wedge product defines an m form on the m simplex, so it makes sense to integrate. Right? And multiply all of this by the diagram underlying the pairing. The diagram underlying the pairing is a diagram is a core diagram whose skeleton is a part of a knot, or whose skeleton is a braid. Okay? So I guess I have to define the space of core diagrams whose skeleton is the skeleton corresponding to a braid. Okay? So I need to define the target space of this invariant. The target space is A of n vertical strands, and A of n vertical strands, here are two definitions. One definition is pictorial. You look at all ways of connecting those m vertical strands, an element of A of n vertical strands will be a particular way of, well, constructing a ladder with sort of n, writing a horizontal core diagram on n vertical strands. The picture is better than the words, okay? Even if the picture in itself is lousy. Is it clear? But then mod out by the same 4T relation as before. What's the 4T relation? So I should remind you that the 4T relation was, the 4T relation said that if you have one chord here, then the sum of all ways of connecting another chord starting at some fixed point near the ends of that chord is equal to zero, sum with signs. But let's translate it to braid language. So translated to braid language, you'll have a chord here and another chord starting somewhere else, and you will sum over all possible ways of connecting it near the ends, of connecting the new one near the ends of that one. Okay? And if I were to be specific about the signs, well, let me be specific about the signs. If this is strand J, this is strand K, this is strand I, let me denote by, well, let me name a chord going from I to J, T-I-J. A chord going from J to K, I'll call T-J-K. Okay? So, in fact, the diagram written here, as it is written right now, is... Oh, I'm used to writing products from the bottom to the top. So this is, in fact, T-I-J. Sorry, so this diagram is T-J-K times T-I-J.
What T represents?
T represents a chord going from... T is just a name. It's just a letter in English, okay? So maybe, I could have used C to denote chord, but maybe I'm using T to denote, I don't know what, toward. But anyway, but TJK represents a chord going from strand number I to strand number J, from J to K, okay? So of course, by the way, TJK is equal to TKJ because my chords are unoriented. But anyway, now if I want to represent an entire chord diagram, then it will be a product of chords, and my convention will be to read the product from the bottom to the top. So the chord diagram written right now is TJK times TIJ. First TJK, then TIJ. Okay? And with these conventions, the four-term relation will become TJK commutator TIJ plus TIK is equal to zero. You see, commutator means, multiply one way or multiply the other way. So overall there are four terms when you open the parentheses here, and these four terms are exactly all of them have a chord between J and K, and then there is a chord from I to J or a chord from I to K, and it's either above or below the TJK, and the signs are right. Okay? So I think I've now defined the target space of the Concievich integral for braids. No, not quite, because I forgot one thing. In the graphical calculus, it is kind of clear that you can slide chords across each other, because they're diagrams. I'm thinking of these as combinatorial gadgets. So if I have four strands and a chord here and a chord here, it doesn't matter which way they're ordered. But if I want to describe it completely algebraically, and I want to be completely honest, I have to put in not just the 4T relation and the symmetry of the chords, but also a relation saying that if I, J, K, and L are all different from each other, then you can slide TIJ past TKL, meaning they commute. Okay? So now the target space of this invariant is clear, and the only thing that remains is to show that it is an invariant. How much time do I have? What?
Not any positive amount.
Sorry?
No, we are out of time.
Oh, we're out of time. So just maybe, so I'll do it next hour, but yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. So how do you get to the Grouse circle to the particle thing? Is there a way to see that? Like,
let me
cut the circle.
So at some point I will restart and do talk about finite type invariants of braids, okay? But for now, you see, I sort of wanted to start from the simplest, which is, well, not the simplest, maybe the most known, the most, well, maybe I'll say something negative about the most known thing at some point, but anyway, I wanted to start from knots. Anyway, sorry, you know what, let me just answer your question. Basically, Mark, look at this interval, call it I. Look at this interval, call it K. Look at this interval, call it J. Okay? And just move them to be on top of this I, this J, and this K, while moving the chords with you. So you will have a chord going from J to K. This is this one. Okay? Other questions?
This invariant is an integer?
Sorry?
You have an integer invariant?
Integer?
Yeah.
No, it's not. Nothing here is an integer.
Why are you putting normalization?
Which normalization?
2 pi i.
You're asking too early because I haven't yet proven anything. But, this invariant, so you're asking why the 2 pi i to the m. So you see, no, it's not to make it an integer. This invariant not only, as an invariant of knots, it is, so the original Concievich integral, not for braids, the one I wrote before for knots, actually has rational values, but it's a very hard theorem. Well, not very, but somewhat hard theorem. Okay, wait. For braids, it is not remotely rational. Not only the coefficients are not integers, they're not remotely rational, and I'll have a statement to make about it later. Okay? But that's not what the 2 pi I to the m does. The 2 pi I to the m is to guarantee that it's a universal finite type invariant. It's to guarantee that when you evaluate it on an m singular knot, you will have a coefficient of 1 here. If I had not divided by 2 pi I to the m, it would be equally well an invariant, but the coefficient here will be wrong. Okay, so that's what the 2 pi I to the m is doing. Okay? And really, you know, if you want a little bit more about where is it coming from, this should remind you of the Cauchy form, whose integral measures rotation numbers in the plane. So, if you ignore all the other stuff that goes around it, there is some measurement of how much one strand spins around the other. But then you want to, but if you want this measurement to be in with integer values, you have to divide by 2 pi I. And that's this 2 pi I. Okay? Other questions? Okay, let's meet again.